Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, September 21st, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Bill Evel from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Now, a look at some of the top stories for the week. Patrick, we're going to start with the story that many people felt might come, but we all hoped it wouldn't. Cape saw its first shark fatality this past weekend. Cape Cod Times was on this right away, and you covered it very well. Number of angles to this. Let's start with the incident itself.
Sure, the basics, as a lot of people will have heard at this point, but just to go over them really quickly, shortly after noon on Saturday, there was a report of a shark bite, and this took place at Newcomb Hollow Beach, which is the northernmost beach in Wellfleet. As you said, we dispatched a number of reporters there and soon discovered that that bite had become a fatal attack on this individual. He was a 26-year-old man from Revere, Arthur Medici. He had originally come from Brazil about 4 years later, by all accounts.
4 years ago, yes.
4 years ago, yep. And, or 4 years ago, sorry. By all accounts, he was a young man who really enjoyed being in the water, really enjoyed surfing. He was a very active young man. He was a student at Bunker Hill College part-time. And it was something where obviously people were in shock, I think, still by the time we got there and started talking to people. It was interesting because there were still people arriving at the beach, and it's unclear whether they even knew that it had occurred. That stretch, as many people will know, is along the Outer Cape, the Atlantic-facing beaches, and there were beaches, you know, to the north and south where there were still people going in the water at that point. They had closed Newcomb Hollow Beach to swimming and to surfing or anything of that kind at that point. It stayed closed for several days after that. And Medici was picked up by Wellfleet Ambulance and taken to Cape Cod Hospital, where he was pronounced dead. Just yesterday, we confirmed what was, I guess, obvious to many, that the cause of death was basically loss of blood from this shark bite. And in talking to witnesses, they said that when he was pulled from the water, he really wasn't even bleeding at that point. And that gives you a sense of how much blood was lost so quickly and how severe these particular bites were. It came exactly a month after the bite at Longnook Beach in Truro, where a New York man was bitten. He survived those bites, but they were severe in that case as well. And in both cases, the one thing that struck me was how people who were on the beach, who were just, you know, regular folks in some cases people with medical training, did really act fast as they could and looked for ways to apply tourniquets. In the case of Medici, the leash of the boogie board that he was on was used initially. A dog leash was used. It goes to show that, again, in those areas, people are trying to look out for each other, and it's a place where you're not that far from the fire station, you're not that far from a response, but in a case like this,
there's not even much cell service out there.
There's not much. It's a big thing that came up, and certainly in the Truro incident, and again here was the lack of cell coverage, and how do you get that report in as quickly as possible, because every minute counts. I think in the case of Medici, every second counts, and I don't know if anything could have been done because of the extent of the damage to his legs, it sounds like. But in any case, that again, that willingness to jump in and try and help out, because you really do need somebody to start trying to staunch the flow of blood as quickly as possible. And that's something first responders have said to us as well.
So Medici was boogie boarding that afternoon. He and a friend were there. And how far? They weren't that far off the beach.
They weren't that far off the beach. I think they were about 300 yards south of where the parking lot is, but only about 30, 35 feet off the beach, according to witnesses. That's an area where there are a lot of troughs and sandbars, and as the tide goes in and out, those troughs and sandbars, in a lot of respects, are places where people do find these waves. And when I arrived at the beach that day, you could see the waves rolling in, and you could imagine the temptation of for surfers and for boogie boarders to be on those waves. They're really well-formed waves. I think a lot of people maybe don't always know that Cape Cod has this great break that occurs along the beaches. And boogie boarders and surfers certainly take advantage of that. But it's also because of those sandbars that you see a lot of these seals coming in and taking up, you know, residence there. Eventually, essentially, the Truro is one of the three largest haulouts for seals on Cape Cod. Monomoy being the largest one. You know, thousands, tens of thousands of seals have congregated there. Truro being the second largest one, and then around the corner in the bay at Jeremy Point in Wellfleet being the third largest one. So it's a place where seals gather. Obviously, everybody said seals, you know, attract sharks and have attracted these sharks to our waters in recent years.
Your headline from Tuesday on the story is "Now What?" And that kind of sums up the questions a lot of people have been asking after this fatality. What steps can be taken to prevent a replay of this kind of tragedy?
And officials are looking at that. They've been looking at that before this occurred and how to prevent these types of attacks. The first occurred in 2012 in recent history here on the Cape, and that man, a Colorado man, survived. Again, the one in August and then this one. But as you said at the top, everybody knew this was coming, essentially, and everybody had, you know, who we talked to said, yeah, it was inevitable. We've talked about it in the newsroom that it seems inevitable. There have been talks for the past 5 years by a regional working group, Shark Working Group, which is Cape Cod National Seashore folks, folks on the Outer Cape, folks from the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, the State Division of Marine Fisheries have been getting together and kind of bouncing around ideas, looking at the use of cameras floated on balloons was one idea that came up last year. The cost became something that they thought was just too much. It was going to be $300,000 for 12 weeks, and that's really, I think, would may have been only really one location. So they were looking at that and saying that's just too expensive. And they've come up with, obviously, the signs that you see at the beaches through those working groups, and they're very clear. There's pictures of sharks. It's basically saying, you know, there are sharks in these waters. Even when we don't have people reporting that there's shark sightings, and it's interesting to us because whenever you hear a number of shark sightings along the coast, you can almost guarantee that the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy and the Division of Marine Fisheries are out looking for them, and they're reporting them. But that's just because they're there that those reports are coming in. And Greg Skomel, the expert on sharks here at the state of Massachusetts, has said to me and said to others I know, listen, they're there all the time. The fact that we're reporting them or somebody sees one, that's just the fact that they saw them. But they're there when you don't see them as well. And so this idea has been reinstilled, and obviously there's a Shark Smart programming where they say, you know, don't swim with seals, don't swim at dusk or dawn. There's all sorts of things that they say people have to be careful about.
This is midday on a Saturday.
Midday on a Saturday, and I think that's something that struck a lot of people. It wasn't dusk, it wasn't dawn. I haven't heard yet whether there were a lot of seals in the water, but I know we went out there, I think, a couple days later, or the next day,
you have a picture of a surfer same
swimming
spot
next to a seal. Exactly, there were seals there, and so. What can you do? And I think what they're looking at is certainly more vigilance and looking at the communication system. And again, if something does happen, how fast can you communicate that to first responders? Secondly, is there anything you can do in terms of surveillance that's done? I mean, drones, it's 2018. There's drones that are capable of looking at these things. Cost is obviously a factor. You know, battery life is a factor. There's all sorts of reasons why that could be difficult. But I think they're at the point where they're looking at whatever they can do. And then there's the next idea, or not idea, but the next concept, which Brian Carlstrom from the Cape Cod National Seashore and others have said, Greg Skomel, listen, they're there. We have to change our behavior as humans in terms of how we interact with the ocean here on the Cape. And we have to know they're there, and we have to be not going in too deep and being aware that at any point in time you could be in that danger. That's not enough for some people. Some people are looking for seals populations to be reduced, and some have even talked about reducing the shark population in a more specific way. That's a tough thing to think is going to happen. The Marine Mammal Protection Act protects the seals. The sharks are protected as well. And you'd have to be changing federal laws, and you'd also have to get past quite a pushback from environmentalists and people who are not interested in having a swimming pool for an ocean, who are interested in the natural world and the fact that it exists, and they are in many ways proponents of that.
There is more to the story, and we may have a chance to talk about it a little bit more toward the end of the program. But right now, I want to speak with Bill Evel, who's on the line from the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Bill, Martha's Vineyard Striped Bass and Bluefish Derby is underway. This week saw the passing of the Derby's president, a local figure, a big loss. His name was Ed Jerome.
Exactly. The island is really mourning at the moment. Ed Jerome, he died on Tuesday unexpectedly at the age of 71 while shellfishing. Now, he's been the Martha's Vineyard Striped Bass and Bluefish Derby for as long as people remember. He really revived the tournament in the 80s, and he just personified this tournament that began on September 9th. We did a story, went to see him on the opening bell Sunday morning of September 9th, and he was looking pale and hearty, welcoming everybody as he always does, and really, you know, he is the Derby. And so it's been a real loss to the community the day he died, and every day since. Down at the weigh-in station, little shack down at the Egertown dock, it's really become, you know, now part fishing derby, but really part wake that just keeps going on as people are down there swapping stories and remembering a man who, by all accounts, everyone loved. He was also principal of the Egertown School for 25 years, so a real pillar of the community. One of the things that people always remember, and you can really see him every year, at the end of the derby, the last day, there's this great ceremony where the winners, the leaders of all the four fish categories, the striped bass, the bluefish, the albies, and the bonita, they're up on stage. And there's a category for shore caught and a category for boat caught. And everybody gets a key, all these winners. And they put it in a lock. And the shore winners are going for a boat. They get to win a boat. And the people who win from the boat get a truck. And Ed always presided over this moment, and it's really, you know, a great lot of tense moments. Everybody's excited, and I guess Ed would, you know, stay up all night worried and exhausted. The keys wouldn't fit. He'd be oiling them all night, but he really presided over that, and you could see his face every year in the pictures cheering along with whoever won the boat or the truck that year, and that's a memory that a lot of people take with them. The one solace is that the Derby is continuing. It goes through October. So everybody really knows what to do to honor Ed. They go fishing. You know, the camaraderie of it, being in the nature at the vineyard time of year. So everybody has a place to put their sadness at the weigh-in stations and out on the water. So that's the one nice thing that at this time of year. There is visiting hours today from 4 to 7 at Chapman Colin Gleason Funeral Home on Egertown Vineyard Haven Road. And the funeral is tomorrow at 11 a.m. at St. Elizabeth's in Egertown. So I just want to say, you know, just everybody's thinking about Ed, and our hearts go out to his family, and we'll be thinking of him every time we drop a line in the water.
Remembering Ed Jerome, Bill Evel from the Vineyard Gazette. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. And welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And Patrick, Hurricane Florence came ashore on North Carolina. We've seen some terrible images of flooding and devastation. Some people from the Cape region have gone down to help.
Yeah, and this often happens with disasters like this. It happened with Hurricane Harvey in Texas and Hurricane Maria. And in this case, we had a number of different organizations. The Barnesville County Technical Rescue Team sent a 10 swift water rescue experts and equipment down to North Carolina, where they were going to be staging and being prepared to be dispatched to help in cases that are obviously happening down there with flooding. I know that the American Red Cross, the Cape and Islands chapter, two folks from the Cape, one from Brewster and one from Marston's Mills, went down and were helping out. And the International Fund for Animal Welfare, I know, just kind of found out recently, they have folks down there who are helping with animal rescues, obviously, as again, you know, has been the case. Interestingly enough, there are some folks from the Cape who we contacted or who come and visit the Cape often, basically summer folks who are down there. Rob Zappel, a county commissioner in Wilmington, North Carolina, summered in Harwich since 1952, and he's down there and gave us a little bit of a feeling of what it was like. He said there were 100 to 105 mile per hour winds. He felt his windows were going to break right open. And again, these are people who, you know, we're sending people down here from various organizations to help out, and there are some people down there who actually know the Cape well and come and visit it quite often. There are also folks who, from a group called the Marco Patriots. And these are kind of, if you'll remember, in some of these instances where kind of just citizens get their boats together and go out with their boats or jet skis and start rescuing people because the need was so great at times like Harvey. This was a group that was formed basically doing that out of Florida. There's a strong Marco Island, Cape Cod connection, and that's where they're coming from. But they also, you know, live on the Cape part time, and so they're citizens who are going down and we're taking a couple of boats and jet skis down to try and help out. We're still trying to gather some information about kind of what kind of rescues these folks were involved in. But more officially, the Coast Guard from Air Station Cape Cod had sent a helicopter crew down and a number of other people. I think they had sent 13 people altogether from Air Station Cape Cod with this helicopter crew and an Osprey aircraft that was doing reconnaissance. The helicopter crew was involved in moving some people basically between hospitals that had lost power. And so they were already kind of in the mix as they've been in other instances.
We have Tim Wood with us on the line from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, you have an article touching on how this week's fatal shark attack has raised concern for many about the Cape's growing seal population. Patrick was touching on this earlier. Lay out what you have for us.
Well, yeah, it's really brought to the fore some of these long simmering concerns. You know, the burgeoning seal population, a lot of people tie it directly to the sharks, and as we've seen in videos posted online, and you know, the seals seem to be drawing the sharks closer to the shore, and you know, people are pointing the fingers at seals as being sort of responsible for the part of this issue. Lately, however, seals, at least down here in the Chatham area, have been showing up in places where there haven't been sharks yet, like some of the smaller inlets, Oyster Pond and Mill Pond, and even along Nantucket Sound beaches, a couple of which were closed here this summer because after lifeguards spotted seals swimming by the swimming beaches. Now, this week, the Board of Selectmen here in Chatham heard some concerns from residents who are worried that if the seals are in these locations, the sharks maybe can't be far behind. Resident Elaine Gibbs said it just takes one shark to figure out that there are seals in Oyster Pond, which has a popular family beach and where the town holds its swimming lessons during the summer. And she said that's sort of like a disaster waiting to happen. Add that to the other concerns people have expressed about seals down here, you know, their impact on water quality, the fish, and the fishermen, of course, have notoriously disliked seals. That's kind of putting it mildly. Mm-hmm. And the danger from bites from seals. I remember a few weeks ago here in Chatham, a couple people were bitten by seals at Rider's Cove Town Landing. But of course, the seals are protected by the Marine Mammal Protection Act. There's very little that local communities can do about this. And, you know, certainly the idea some people have floated about trying to cull the seals. That's not really going to happen without a change in the federal law. And now town officials in Chatham have been discussing these issues with the Northwest Atlantic Seal Research Consortium. And they've been talking about public education, particularly keeping people away from seals, discouraging them from feeding them, which is against the law anyway. Mm-hmm. But that's seals have learned to hang around fishing boats looking for handouts, and that's part of the issue. Now, the consortium says that while the seal population is pretty high right now, you know, their estimates 40,000 or more seals in the region. They probably reflects an unusual high because of the recovery of the species, and that may be higher than their natural level, which at some point the population will reach. They say there's really no reliable numbers of what the seal population was like before the numbers were decimated by bounties and other factors. And so while there's a lot of attention focused on the seals right now, the range of options seem to be very limited, if there are any at all. To further explore this, the town and the consortium are setting the stage for some a forum that they'd like to hold this winter to educate people about the seals and to maybe talk more about these issues.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for that.
Thank you, Steve.
With me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Patrick, Cape Cod Community College is in the news after their nursing program was identified by the state as having issues. Explain what's happening here.
Well, they had had a problem with the passing rate, basically how many folks passed the licensing exam who went through the associate degree program for registered nurses there at Cape Cod Community College in West Barnstable. It had been 93% in 2015, which was well above the 80% required by the state. But in 2016, it fell to 79%, and in 2017, it fell to 69%. And once that happened, the state came in and basically said that they were, you know, on a warning status. It doesn't mean that their accreditation is gone or anything like that, but what it means is they have to take corrective action, and they have about 12 months to correct the problem, according to the state. The college says they've already taken kind of action to take care of this. They've provided financial support for folks in the nursing program so that they can take the test immediately after graduating, and they say that's key because, you know, if you don't have the money to take the test right away and you wait some time and then you're forgetting the information and then you're not getting into nursing a nursing job essentially right away, you're going to start to lose that information. And so by doing that, they're getting them into those positions faster and allowing them to pass at a better rate. And in May, the most recent test, 77 had taken the test, and 85% of them had passed. That was of 90 nurses who had graduated. That's according to the college. So they're saying they're really taking some steps in trying to add more support to the nurses who are going through that program and giving them extra help, essentially, to try and get that number back up.
We're going to speak right now with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, a big change at the island school system where the 9-year superintendent is leaving the school system. You had a chance to speak with him.
We did. Michael Kozort is stepping down, retiring as superintendent of the Nantucket Public School System after almost a decade at the helm. A lot of changes, a lot of growth during that time. And he did sit down with us this week and talked about his tenure and what the future for him and what the future he sees maybe for the schools. He said, basically, it's time. He's been the superintendent for, again, nearly a decade. And time for a new voice, he said, who can lead the school into the future, and time for him to maybe pursue other things. He talked a little bit about some of the issues and the challenges over the years on Nantucket. He came to Nantucket from a rural school in New Hampshire as a superintendent and said some of the issues were the same, but mostly, he said, recruiting and retaining teachers was the biggest challenge he saw the school system facing on an island with some pretty severe affordable housing issues. Finding teachers to come to the island, new teachers, experienced teachers, and then stay was something that's difficult. He said that the pool is shallower here because you simply can't get people to necessarily come out to the island if they don't have a good place to live. And those that have been here for a while, they're trained, they become experienced in the school system. And if they can't afford a home, they'll take those talents elsewhere. So he said that was one of the biggest challenges. And another one, a challenge as well as a strong point he felt for the school, and one of his proudest accomplishments was the success the school has had in integrating the diversity over the last few years. He said when he got to the school, there were 60 English language learning students, students who did not have English as a first language, and there is more than 350 today. And that, again, poses challenges to a relatively small school system in integrating those students not only into the academic world and the schools, but also into the community, them and their families. And he said he felt the school, schools in general, have made a really strong success there, but a lot of progress. Again, a lot of progress, but a lot of challenges ahead, too, to continue with that. The diversity continues to grow on Nantucket, and it's always a challenge with balancing budgets and accommodating those students. He doesn't know exactly what he's going to do yet. He may stick around for a little while, he said, depending on how long it takes the system to find a new superintendent. That's never easy. The superintendents face similar issues as far as housing and you know, as well out here. So he said he could might stick on for a little while until that successor is found. He's a big soccer fan, a soccer referee. He said he might get into coaching some youth sports. He said he's really going to miss are the kids out here. He said working with the adults was part of the job, but he really got into this to work with kids, and he found he was doing a little bit less of that than he used to, which is one of the reasons he decided to step down.
Josh, another story you have, the Nantucket Wine and Food Festival was denied permission to use town property for its culinary tent next year due to something called excessive transgressions. Tell us about this.
That's what the town licensing agent called the the reason for the select board on Wednesday night denying the Nantucket Wine and Food Festival the right to use Jetty's Beach for their what they call their culinary village, a big tent that had a number of food vendors and food purveyors, as well as some of the wine and spirits purveyors and events there. Amy Baxter, the town's licensing agent, told the select board, and some select board members expressed their own observations that it was simply much bigger crowd than was anticipated. It caused traffic jams, and there were some violations of town liquor laws due with serving and with the people carrying alcohol where they might not have, the town didn't want them to. So the board voted 4-1 to suspend their permit for Jetty's next year, but they did give them the option of coming back in a month with a new plan, with some guarantees that these issues would be addressed, and they could potentially reopen that vote and vote again. If they uphold the denial, the Wine and Food Festival would have to find a new place for their culinary village, their culinary tent, which they said they would do. This is not any kind of cancellation or any kind of prohibition on the Wine and Food Festival itself, just the use of town property for this tent. So they could find private property either on one of the hotel properties that they're already using or elsewhere, someplace like Bartlett Farm perhaps. The Wine Festival organizers acknowledged that the event was bigger than they had anticipated, that it did get a little out of hand, and they have vowed to work with the town and to work internally to address these issues and be back next year somewhere with the culinary tent and as the festival as a whole.
Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
We're going to speak right now with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning.
Casey, you've got a profile this week of a Provincetown resident who's a familiar face along Commercial Street and who has lost his home and is now facing an uncertain future.
Yes, this is a story of Frederico, or Freddie Rocha. He has been evicted from his family home at the age of 67. And this is a story that's really about a small town that has a vibrant street scene, a small street that everyone commonly shares. And Freddie has been a fixture of the street for about 40 years. He's very interactive with people. He asks for cigarettes and money all the time, but it's kind of his entree to talk to people more than a form of street begging. And Freddie, I guess, has been diagnosed with schizophrenia, though the diagnosis has fluctuated over the years. But in any case, his sister and brother have maintained his family home off Commercial Street for years and years and years so that he could live in it. But his father passed away, and his mother's in a nursing home, and they are in a position where they can no longer afford to keep that house, so they're going to sell it. And failing to find any solution for him to get into another housing, they had him evicted. And so now the question is, how easily does a community let this man that everybody knows and cares for go? And apparently the answer is, in Provincetown anyway, not easily. A GoFundMe account raised over $5,000 for Freddie's living expenses in just a few days. And a photographer and artist, David Chick, who has been photographing Freddie and has a relationship with him and has for years, has taken him in, and Freddie's staying on his couch. And in the meantime, David Chick and other people are running around trying to get him a year-round place to live and some services to help him, because at his age and with his mental condition, you know, he's obviously a vulnerable person. So Freddie's story is really, it's very interesting to me, because to me it's more than a story about affordable housing. It's also about vulnerable people. And how do we as a community handle somebody with a complex set of needs? It's been heartwarming so far, I have to say. Julie Grande, the owner of the Box Lunch in Provincetown, she plans to name a sandwich after him. It's his favorite sandwich, a chicken salad sandwich, and the proceeds can help him. And she said that Freddie is very inspirational to me. He shows me life can change, and we have to appreciate everything, every little accomplishment. He's a human being, and it doesn't matter what shape or size that's in. So I think that's a hopeful sign, even though this is somebody's life and a very vulnerable person's life on the line, and the idea of him leaving Provincetown is horrific to him and horrific to enough people that it looks like he's getting a lot of help right now.
Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thank you for joining us with that.
Thank you.
With me is Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, a couple of interesting stories around the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe this week. There's a tribe company that's looking to take over wastewater treatment at Joint Base Cape Cod.
Yeah, it's really a good news, bad news couple of weeks for the tribe. This is the Mashpee Wampanoag Community Development Corporation. They're not run by tribal government leaders, but they were set up as this separate entity to pursue, obviously, economic development projects. And in this case, they've responded to a statement of need by Joint Base Cape Cod, which is looking to have somebody take over their wastewater treatment operation. And this tribal corporation says that they're willing to do that and are interested in doing that. They're concerned about the environment. They're concerned about nitrification, and that has to do with the wastewater running through groundwater and into local water bodies. The base, meanwhile, through the colonel there, says that they're interested in this. The potential exchange would provide the base with an option towards this long-term solution for water and wastewater management. So still have to see if kind of all the needs and abilities line up there, but it certainly seems like there's some interest on both sides in making this happen.
We are going to the break right now. This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. When we come back, we'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup. On the Point, we're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker, and with me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Patrick, we're going to continue speaking about the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe here. The other big story out this week on the tribe, a nice one, is about its language program landing a big funding grant.
Yeah, this is the Wampanoag Language Reclamation Project. They've been working for a number of years to really help young tribe members reclaim the tribe's language, which was really lost and not spoken for many years. They received a $1.4 million grant from the U.S. Department of Education to help expand teaching the curriculum for young people in the tribe and outside the tribe in the Mashpee Public Schools system. This is a five-year, basically, grant that they'll get. And they say it's really important, obviously, to keep this language because it helps them maintain their culture. Interestingly enough, this came up in a testimony recently by the tribe vice chairwoman who was speaking down in D.C., and she said that, you know, basically having their land was really needed in order to do things like this, to have their schools, the school that had been put in place to teach this language. And she was speaking to the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs in August and said that they really needed that land to do that. That land is in jeopardy, and for anybody who hasn't been paying attention, or quick recap, the tribe's land in trust, which the federal government had given it back in 2015, had taken land into trust, 321 acres in Mashpee and Taunton, had been challenged by the neighbors of a casino that was planned for Taunton, and during that challenge, a judge basically sent that decision back to the Interior Department and said, nope, this doesn't work. The Interior Department reconsidered how they had taken that land into trust, and then came back just recently and said, it's not going to work. We're not going to be able to take this land into trust for the tribe. They said for the moment it stays in trust while an appeal of that lawsuit goes forward. And there's a bill, essentially, that's been brought forward by U.S. Representative William Keating and folks on the Senate side from Massachusetts that would essentially eliminate this challenge to their land in trust and would essentially give the tribe their land in trust through an act of Congress, which would be a law, essentially, and could be upheld that way. We have a story in today's paper by reporter Tanner Stenning looking at not only pushback to that bill from the Republican side, because as we just outlined, Keating and some of the other folks here in Massachusetts who are pushing this bill are Democrats. One of those folks is Elizabeth Warren, Senator Elizabeth Warren, who has a very contentious relationship with President Donald Trump. And not only are some of the people who are pushing back against this bill Republicans against these Democrats, there are some Democrats in Rhode Island who are now saying that they're not interested in seeing this bill go forward, and they're saying they're doing this to protect the gaming interests that are down there in Rhode Island. They have a couple of casinos down there, and they're saying they really don't like the idea of basically this bill going forward. the tribe, if they had a casino on their own in southeastern Massachusetts, would not be paying would pay taxes, but they would probably be less than what a normal casino would pay. If they had any competition in southeastern Massachusetts, they wouldn't pay any taxes. So I think folks with other gaming interests and who are supporting other gaming interests, like these representatives, lawmakers down in Rhode Island, see that as an uneven playing field and are trying to protect their developers down there who are moving forward with casinos. The tribe obviously says, listen, this is our due. We you know, our land was taken from us in the past, and this is kind of why we're allowed to move forward with these things. And if you're going to do this again, you're essentially going to be taking our land again. And they're saying that's just unfair.
Obviously. And that this is politics. They're on one side of a political push. And
I think they said the ugly side of politics was something that the chairman, Cedric Cromwell, had mentioned to Tanner.
We're going to speak right now with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve, and good morning, Patrick.
Morning, George.
George, Farm Neck Golf Club has been involved in a lawsuit over the way it pays employees. This appears to be resolved with a judge's decision this week.
That's right. This lawsuit was brought by a kitchen worker at Farm Neck. She was concerned, $16 an hour employee. She worked a couple of overtime shifts and was not paid time and a half. I learned something new this week, Steve. I wasn't aware that there was an exemption for seasonal businesses, and that seems to be the case here. Judge ruled that there are two exemptions. One of them is just a straight seasonal business, and then the other one is if your profits during a certain season are more than one third of what you make the rest of the year, you're exempt as well. And that's where Farm Neck falls in here. Over the course of 6 months, most of that being in the summertime, they earned $6 million, and in the rest of the year it was somewhere around $400,000. I'm sorry. And so obviously, you know, they met that criteria. She filed this suit, you know, because she felt as though employees should be paid time and a half once they reach that 40-hour plateau. But the judge ruled that that was not the case, and we spoke to Farm Neck attorneys as well as the general manager there, and they said, you know, a bunch of things were thrown at the wall in this lawsuit, and none of them stuck. And they're pleased with the judge's ruling, not happy that they had to go through a lawsuit in order to, you know, have this vindication.
And for folks who don't know, maybe Farm Neck Golf Club is kind of a favorite golf club for a couple of presidents.
That's right. You know, Barack Obama, during his presidency and after he's left office, you know, frequent visitor, and as was Bill Clinton, both while he was president and when he visits the island, both enjoy playing golf there.
And the judge in this matter, I thought it was interesting. He, you know, they pointed out that the club was making $6 million over this period of time, but he said it doesn't matter the size of the profit. It's really setting off the profit against the months that it's not profitable, which proves that it's a seasonal business.
That's right. You know, the attorney for the golf course, you know, made the same case in talking to me. I did find it interesting, you know, prices are high over here. I pointed out in the story that on the restaurant's menu, the price of a hamburger at Farm Neck Club is $16, which is about what they were paying that employee per hour.
George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. Take care.
With me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Patrick, the town of Brewster appears to be losing a nursing home there, which means not only a loss of options for seniors, but also a loss of jobs.
Sure. SRC Management, which runs the Wingate at Brewster Nursing Home, says it's going to close down the 173-bed nursing home by mid-January, it sounds like. That's according to state officials and the company. They are going to keep open the assisted living at Brewster, which is kind of a separate facility there that will stay open. And they still have a facility in Harwich, a nursing home in Harwich. And they say some of the people in Brewster can be moved to that facility in Harwich. They're also closing down a nursing home, though, in Providence. They have a residences in Providence as well where they're closing down. So this seems to be part of a trend, as Cynthia McCormick, our reporter, health reporter, is reporting here, of closing of nursing homes in a lot of different areas. And among the different issues that I think come up is finding staff and getting people to work in these places. And then she spoke to Bill Bogdanovich, who's the president and CEO of Broadreach Healthcare in Liberty Commons in Chatham, which runs a nursing home in Chatham. And he said that, you know, it's also the cost in terms of mass health reimbursement, and mm-hmm. it doesn't equate to what the average cost is a day for housing one of these folks. And so that difference means that you can't pursue capital projects and improve the facilities. And that was one of the reasons that SRC management raised here, is that this facility in Brewster was built in the 1970s, and that was one of the driving reasons for their closures, was the challenges of modernizing it. But yes, there will be people out of jobs. I think there are 61 full-time employees there and 11 part-time employees, and it currently has 93 residents, so they're going to have to figure out what to do with all those folks, and whether there can be some people who can get jobs elsewhere within their system, and also move the people who are living there.
And the article pointing out the difference between a nursing facility, a nursing home, and an assisted living facility. And a lot of that has to do with the reimbursements and the people who are there.
Yeah, with the assisted living facilities, essentially privately funded. You pay, you know, what you're paying, and that takes care of the expenses. With the nursing homes, some of that comes through MassHealth.
Orleans officials and boaters are pushing for a solution to the problems at Nauset Estuary, which is filling in, making boating difficult and maybe even dangerous.
Sure, and full disclosure, you chose this story. I do go in and out of the estuary, so I want everybody to be aware of that as they're listening to me, and I won't take any position in this case, but it is an estuary that has had issues, according to local fishermen, town officials, boaters, recreational boaters as well. It's an area where the channel really meanders quite a bit and changes from year to year, and they're saying it's really being choked out, and you really are having a tough time. Even on a good day, getting in and out of there is a four-hour window or so. And they're saying it's getting even worse. The owner of Goose Hummock there in Orleans said, interestingly enough, that he's having to take his boat, which is a larger boat, and go all the way to Truro. So he's having to travel basically 3 hours, go to Truro, put his boat in, go all the way around, and come back around to Nauset 3 hours later for something that's essentially, you know, a half hour away, just going off Nauset from Goose Hummock where he is. And so they're looking for some emergency dredging is what they're really hoping for. They're talking and putting together a group to talk about how they could get through the permitting process for some dredging. And I think what came up during that was the window for doing that put it out to 2021 or 2022. And
like 3 or 4 years from now.
And Orleans selectman essentially said, that simply doesn't work. It was Selectman Kevin Galligan said that about that timeline. And commercial fisherman in town, Mike Naughton, said, well, why don't we look at limiting the scale, and maybe that would help make that work faster. But they're working with the Woods Hole group to try and figure out what's possible here. Interestingly enough, the last time Nauset Estuary was dredged was 1924. It cost $1,000, if you can believe it. And I bet you there wasn't that much permitting going on back then. So, I mean, I think that it's something that you're 100 years later, they're saying it's time to be done. But again, you can imagine the way those sands move around. You dredge it, and then, you know, what happens if the next year we saw something similar in Sandwich, where they put sand on the beach? Mm-hmm. What happens the next year if that sand all gets moved around and all that dredging goes for naught? So I'm sure they're all considering this and looking at the science involved.
Kristen Young, your reporter, has a story about a neat program in Dennis. The town has received a grant to get into the glass recycling business.
Yeah, and anybody who's been following recycling recently knows that there have been some issues, certainly with China stopping to take recycling, their resistance to continuing to accept a lot of recycling from the United States. But there have also been some glass recycling closures in terms of facilities, and I think the only one in the state or something was in Franklin, and that was closed down recently, and that really caused a lot of panic because people didn't know where they were going to send, towns didn't know where they were going to send their glass recycling. Well, as it turns out, glass can be used once it's basically chopped up fine enough to help essentially do road work. And they say that
they crush it.
They crush it up, and they say that once you crush it up to the right level, you can walk on it. You can, you know, it's fine enough where obviously glass, once it's crushed up fine enough, it's sand. I mean, but this is slightly larger than that, and you can walk on it, but it also can be used as the undersurface for roads. And so what they're doing in Dennis is they've got this grant for $120,000 from the DEP, the State Environmental Protection Agency, and they're going to start up this glass recycling facility. They're going to take in glass from other towns. Other towns have expressed interest in this because they need to do something with their glass at this point, and they're going to make this material that they then can send back to those towns to use on their roads or use in the town of Dennis, or send elsewhere, essentially, and make some money off it. And so they're doing that, kind of filling this need and this problem of recycling being an issue that again, has a lot of problems with it right now from the looks of it.
One of the interesting things in this article I want to point out, Kristen Young points has detailed here that Cape Towns produce about 2,000 tons of glass recyclables annually, and this is a rate of tonnage that's higher than many other Massachusetts towns, according to officials. And they say that really it's because of the number of glass bottle beverages consumed in the busy summer season.
Exactly.
Here on the Cape.
We all know people come here for a good time during the summer, and apparently that's adding to our recycling.
I want to circle back. We have a few minutes here at the end of the program. I want to circle back to the shark story, and we left a couple there that we should take a moment to talk about. There was even a political turn to the story this week, and what really amounted to some finger-pointing in one case about how this was being handled.
Yeah, and this goes hand in hand with this question of what you do going forward. The Barnstable County Commissioners took up, they're the executive branch of Barnstable County government. There are three of them. And this week they took up the issue with an agenda item at their meeting. And they essentially said, well, we don't really have the jurisdiction here to deal with sharks. As you can imagine, county commissioners wouldn't. But they said, we can act as a facilitator. And so they were talking about that. And the chairman of that board, Leo Kakunis, started talking about how he thought that state legislators, essentially the state delegation for the Cape and Islands, had really dropped the ball on this, and that they weren't doing enough, hadn't done enough. Once he said that, our reporter, Jeff Spillane, who was there, certainly reached out to some members of that delegation and said, well, what do you think about what he said, and he was fairly, you know, blunt about it, and that got some reaction from State Senator Julian Sear, who said that there has been work done on it. They're holding meetings, you know, this week. They're getting together with the municipal officials on the Outer Cape and the Cape Cod National Seashore in particular, and he pointed back at Mr. Kakunis and said, county should be a part of that. They, you know, we're committed to working with the county, but, you know, as far as pointing fingers, you should really be a part of what we're doing out here. The county is saying that they want to put together a meeting. The municipal officials and the Outer Cape officials and the Cape Cod National Seashore are holding a meeting, and then they're talking about a public meeting. You know, as earlier mentioned, the meeting in Chatham about seals, the shark working group. I mean, it's a lot of meetings, so it does seem like somebody maybe needs to take all this and kind of put it together. But again, it became a little political in terms of kind of this pointing back and forth. State's Representative Randy Hunt took it a little less personal and just said, people get emotional, they say certain things, I'm not going to take it personally. We still are working with the county on various things, and we'll continue to do so going forward. But obviously all that talk, I think a lot of people are saying, has to amount to something, and something needs to come out of it, and having a lot of meetings is really not going to do you much good unless there's an outcome there. So I think everybody's kind of looking for that going forward.
Well, having this shark fatality happen this past weekend, I think a lot of people want to see something happen. You think that we had a man bitten a month ago, and now again this somebody this past weekend, and this time it's fatal, and it doesn't really show any indication that it's going to go away, the issue, and maybe only going to continue sort of becoming a bigger issue. And so people want some answers or want to have some sense that it's being addressed at some level.
Absolutely. And again, the thing I heard again and again was it's changed the conversation. And, and it's still a conversation at this point, and there are still things being done at the same time, but it changed the tenor of the conversation and the urgency with which that conversation needs to happen as far as a lot of people are concerned.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank the maestro, Patrick Cassidy from Cape Cod Times. Thank you for joining us, Patrick.
Thank you, Steve.
And thanks to our other contributors. We spoke with Bill Evel at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We checked in with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.